Good afternoon, Bay Area. Welcome to the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darden, where every week we tap into the Bay Area art scene and bring you rich conversations with artists. On today's show, a San Francisco actor who was recently nominated for a Tony will chat about the podcast Folk Tales from Sudan and a one-man band known for using tech and Latin music. Today's show is all about being rich in culture. That's all coming up next. Stay with us. Listening to the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darden. Actor Francis Ju recently learned some good news. He received a Tony nomination for his performance in the Broadway play Yellowface. Now, Francis lives in New York, but he's from San Francisco. And the comedy is by playwright David Henry Wong, and it's semi-autobiographical. So back in the 90s, David spoke out against a white actor playing an Asian character in the play Miss Saigon. And in this play, in the current play, he later mistakenly cast a white actor to play the leading Asian character in his own play. So Yellowface is a play within a play, kind of. And Francis plays David's father and other characters. The play is funny and is deep, too, because parts of it takes place during a time in the 90s where Chinese Americans were racially profiled and accused of espionage. Now, you can see a screening of the play Yellowface this Sunday during the Center for Asian American Media's Film Festival, which is called CAMFest. And it'll be followed by a panel discussion with the cast. And joining me is... Tony Award nominee for Best Featured Actor in a Play. You know, I had to be official with it. Francis Ju. Hey, Francis.
Hey, Janae. It's so wonderful to be here with you.
I'm so glad that you're here. And again, we're all excited here in the studio. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. I am flabbergasted and thrilled because I never expected something like this to happen.
I can imagine. What was the feel like when you got the call that you were nominated for a Tony Award?
I couldn't believe it, but I really didn't have time to process it immediately. I had to start talking to reporters and who cover Broadway and try to explain to them how it felt when I had no idea. I was just standing in my living room in my pajamas trying to process, you know?
Yeah, I saw a video of you in your pajamas, like, is this real? Is this real? So has it sunk in yet? Like, does it feel real now?
You know, in 78 years of Tony history, the only Asian actor ever to have been nominated for a Tony for a play on Broadway was B.D. Wong in 1988. Mm-hmm. In 78 years. So this year, there has been just a huge amount of acknowledgement of Asian talent on Broadway. And I'm so, so grateful. I love that I am nominated alongside Daniel Dae Kim,
yes,
who is making history for the very first Asian actor to be nominated for Best Leading role in a play on Broadway.
And that's your co-star. Yes, he's
my co-star, Daniel.
Yeah,
And then David himself was nominated for Best Revival. The three of us being nominated together feels like a hat trick.
Well, I want to dig into that a little bit. But first, this, you know, since you're from the Bay, you're from San Francisco. Now, you were, you know, we gotta play that up. We gotta claim you, Francis. You know, you're one of us.
I'm a San Francisco boy, you know, forever.
I know you're in New York, but you're still one of ours. So you grew up in the Richmond district?
Yes.
Okay.
Born and raised in the Richmond.
Okay. And so did you know growing up here as a kid that you wanted to be an actor?
Oh, yes. I knew I wanted to be an actor as soon as I saw one of my older brothers play the prince in a high school production of The King and I. Oh. I was a shy kid. I couldn't talk to people, even people in my own family. I was really, really shy. And when I first saw, I mean, it was the very first live musical that I ever went to was that high school production of The King and I. And I can still remember the 18-year-old actress playing Mrs. Anna crying on stage while reading that letter from the king. And I remember myself crying, watching this 18-year-old kid playing the king die at the end of the show. And I thought immediately, this is my tribe. This is where I can learn to talk to people and express myself and figure out, you know, the world in a way that I didn't know how to do on my own.
Mm. Well, you know, and in this play, Yellowface, you teach us so much through this character that you play. You play Mr. Henry Wong, the late Henry Wong, Henry Y. Wong. Mm-hmm. He was the founder of the Far East National Bank, which was the first federally chartered bank in the United States that was founded by an Asian American. And his character is funny. He's a little charming. He's kind of out of touch. He romanticizes America. But sometimes he'll say stuff that I'm like, what? But it kind of makes sense.
Don't we think that about our parents all the time?
Yes, yes.
But, you know, I remember that one of the few things that David told me directly about his father was that, one, he stood tall. He was a proud man. Mm-hmm. And second, he told me that whenever his father walked into a room, he was the star.
Oh, I believe that.
And, you know, David could win a Tony Award. He could be on the shortlist for the Pulitzer multiple times. He can write operas that are, you know, produced all over the world. But whenever he was with his dad was the star. And I, you know, took that as permission, really, to go hog wild with this character. And it reminded me a lot of members of my own family. Mm-hmm. In lots of different ways, too.
Was it fun to play him? Because he was so, I mean, and there's times too, he's very serious, but it's not many times he's very serious. But when he is, you know, you hit it out the park, Francis. But
thank
you also
you.
Hit it out the park too with just his personality. He's so self-centered.
Well, you know, Henry was so much braver than I am in real life. And at the same time, he had this radical faith in the ideals mm-hmm. that America says it believes in, like freedom,
right.
Like inclusion. And I am not, you know, I'm still that shy little boy. And I've grown up always having doubts about how far we've come, about whether we do actually live up to those ideals. Mm-hmm. And Henry's optimism that I think he shares with a lot of other immigrants in this country, I think is a real key to him as a character, his essence, and the reason why David wrote him into this play.
Yeah, yeah. And I definitely felt all of that. And I know, too, it's semi-autobiographical. And so, you know, in the play, we learn, and this is in the news if you read old articles, David's father was caught up in a campaign donation scandal during the 90s, you know, with the whole racial profiling of Chinese Americans. And so he was under Senate investigation for his bank's ties to China. But you have to watch the play to see how, you know, how David explains all of that happened back then. I don't want to give it away. So that's where the seriousness comes in too. Even though he still finds humor because he wants attention, so he wants to be in the papers. And
yeah.
He wants attention so bad.
Yeah.
That's why I was like, yeah, go ahead.
He embodied the American dream. I mean, he started off immigrating to America. You know, he wasn't wealthy to begin with. And he, you know, he worked in a laundry when he was younger. Mm-hmm. And eventually he forms this bank. Now, can you imagine a bank in the United States that doesn't accept, you know, deposits from China,
right.
Investment from other countries? And yet, you know, during DonorGate, there were investigations of Asian American owned banks simply because they were Asian American. And none of the charges actually went to trial. None of them, he was never convicted of anything, but his license was revoked.
Mm-hmm.
And they never granted him a new one, even though he was never found guilty of anything. So this man, who like so many other immigrants, just embodied this avid belief in what America stands for, eventually, you know, who lived the American dream,
yeah.
Until it was denied him.
Yeah, that's why I said the play is funny and is really deep too. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with newly Tony nominated actor Francis Ju from the Broadway play Yellow Face. And this Sunday, CAMFest is hosting a screening of the play at the Kabuki Theater in San Francisco, followed by a discussion with some of the cast. And Francis Ju will be there. And also too, just want to let you all know to check out other films being screened this week during CAMFest too as well. So there's a lot for folks to check out. Now, I understand, Francis, so when, and correct me if I'm wrong, so when Yellow Face debuted off Broadway initially in 2007, you weren't cast initially? Or how did that work?
Well, I had done developmental readings for David of the play, but I was not asked to do the play when it first premiered at the Mark Taper Forum in LA. I was younger then, as we all were, and I was told that, I was too young for the part to play David's father, and that David had a really good friend, a wonderful actor, who had done a lot of David's early plays in the 70s, that David had that actor in mind for the part. So he played that in LA, but for whatever reason, was not attached to the show when it came to New York. So I was invited to do the show in New York, and to his credit, on the very first day of rehearsal, David said to the entire company, "I was wrong. Francis is old enough to play this part." Now, I had my own doubts, but it's such a great part. I really wanted to play it.
Yeah. And did it feel different? I mean, you're older now. Did it feel different playing him now?
Oh, my God. I think we've all, changed in the last 15, 20 years, haven't we? I mean, look at what we've experienced. We've gone from the highs of Obama in the White House and us feeling like maybe we're on the cusp of actually becoming a post-racial society. Yeah. Maybe we really are a multiracial democracy, and we can prove to the world that it can actually work. And look at where we are now, where immigrants are being targeted, where we're questioning whether even citizens have the right to due process, where so many disenfranchised people are afraid. And there are a lot of people who are afraid of them. And I think that although David started writing this 20 years ago, he was really prescient. I mean, there's so much about this play that is so current now, 20 years later.
Yeah, I was thinking about that too when I was watching. I said, wow, some of these issues we're still dealing with today. And it's funny because David Wong, I mean, like, again, it's semi autobiographical, and he pokes fun at himself in the play.
Yes.
And I was like, wow, like, which is funny.
He makes more fun of himself than anybody else.
He does. And I was thinking about his father, because his father has such a big ego. So I was just thinking just how different they are anyway. Because I was like, I couldn't see his father doing that. But I was like, if his father wrote a play, he would be like, probably some some action hero or something, right? What do you respect about David Wong's work? Because I know you two, you all go way back.
David, his entire career, I think, has helped give me a voice. Not just because I've done so many of his plays, but because his plays exist, I've learned how to articulate what it means to be an American, to be an artist, to be in a family, to be a son, to be a father. Mm-hmm. There are so many things that I just identify with in the way that he writes that are just so specifically David, but also feel akin to how I speak to myself in my soul. Mm. And he's taught me so much about my own family. Because of his work.
Wow, what a great compliment. What about Daniel Day-Kim, who plays David?
Daniel is an American hero. While Biden was in the White House, he was on a special arts council that met at the White House, you know, and talked and advised the administration on inclusion, on what the arts can do, what how to actually live up to our best ideals. He has always advocated for fair and equitable treatment for people who are not mainstream in this business and in American life. I loved working with him. He worked so incredibly hard. I mean, it's what kind of pressure is there that you're the star of this play on Broadway and that you're portraying the playwright himself who was in the room during rehearsals? And I remember very early in rehearsals, sitting in a chair opposite him, reading a scene and being overcome by this real parental feeling. I'm so proud of him, his integrity, and both on stage and in life. I think he's wonderful. And by the way, he will be at the screening at CanFest on Sunday. So if you wanna ask Daniel a question, you can ask him at the screening.
You know, that's why I like going to screenings when the panel's there, because, you know, a lot of people don't get that access. And what I was pleasantly surprised to see him is in a comedy, to see his comedic chops, because usually he's in like action, you know, like works and mm-hmm. things like that. So it was good to see him in a different role. I hate when people typecast actors, because I'm like, let people spread their wings and do all different types of genres. So, yeah.
Really does in Yellowface as well. I mean, he has such great comic chops, and he goes from, you know, playing this narcissistic writer modeled on David to who is incredibly frustrated with his father and his father's expectations of him, to somebody who understands his dad a little bit more. And, you know, there were so many people in the audience who were not Asian, even not connected to the arts, but who said that the relationship between father and son reminded them of their relationship with their parents.
You know, it's something else. You talked about different people in the audience, and we got to wrap up soon. But something else that was interesting that I noticed about the play is that the play is called Yellowface, and you know the cast is diverse, racially diverse, and you see other non-Asian actors of color playing Asians, which I thought that was interesting, especially because the show is addressing Yellowface, and so it was also I was like, what message is David trying to convey here? Like, I've seen a black woman playing someone Asian, you know, someone that's like Latino. And I thought that was powerful to see that. But I know, too, he's given them permission to portray his people. So that was deep, too.
Yeah. Brilliant actress, black actress, Miranda Anderson, in the very first, 2 minutes of the play, plays Al Gore.
Right.
And then, you know, towards the end of the play, plays David's, you know, Chinese mother.
Mother, yeah.
Dorothy, brilliant Hispanic actor, Kevin De Aguila, at the very first moments of the play, plays B.D. Wong. You know, so I think that the way that David and Lee Silverman, our wonderful director, designed this particular production was that, you know, this is not binary. It's not just about Asian people and white people. This is about what it means to be American, and who gets to decide what that means. Who gets to decide who you are based on what you look like, or what race you are, or what country you came from? Why don't in America do we get to choose?
Yeah, that's what I say. It's a play. It makes you laugh, but it definitely makes you think. Francis, it has been a pleasure, and I'm so excited for you. So congratulations. And again, thank you.
Thank you so much, Janae.
Yes.
I'm so happy to see you.
Yes, I'm so happy to see you too. We have to do this again, definitely in the near future. Yes.
Would love that. Yes. Anytime.
All right, everybody, watch Frances Jew in Yellowface this Sunday, May 11th at the AMC Kabuki Theater in San Francisco during Campfest. And stick around for the in-person discussion with Frances and his fellow castmates. Campfest is running this Thursday through Sunday, so check out their other films. And look out for the Tony Awards so we can cheer on Frances, which will be airing June 8th on CBS. And coming up, we're going into the story world of Sudan. Keep it locked right here. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darden. There's a crisis going on in the world that does not get enough attention. The civil war in Sudan just crossed the two-year mark, and in that time, 13 million people have fled their homes. Now, that's according to the UN Refugee Agency, which says what's happening in Sudan is the largest and fastest-growing displacement crisis in the world. As the great writer Toni Morrison said, it's times like these when artists get to work, and what artists create can help civilizations heal. KALW's very own Hana Baba has created a beautiful podcast for children and us big kids, and it's called Folk Tales from Sudan. And in that beautiful voice of hers, Hana tells stories from her country that ignite the imagination and teach us life lessons. And lucky you, lucky us, we can hear her tell these stories in person at an Oakland Public Library branch near you, near me, because I'm going to be there. And here with me in studio is the lovely Hana Baba. Hello, Hana.
Hey, Janae.
I'm so excited about this podcast of yours.
I am so excited to be on with you as a guest.
Yes, I'm happy you're here. I love the podcast, which, you know, you always, like, do good stuff. So I'm not surprised the podcast is really, really great. Hana, again, you're the host of KLW's Cross Currents. You're the co-host of The Stoop. You're an award-winning journalist. You're a mom. You're fashionista. All that. You smell good.
Fashionista.
And not always be dressed, okay? Okay, so, and I know you've been asked this before, but I love the story. So tell us, what made you create Folk Tales from Sudan?
Yeah, so I grew up listening to my uncle telling folk tales that he heard from his grandma, so my great-grandmother. Mm-hmm. It was when we would go on vacations to Sudan. So I lived in Houston, Texas with my family in the 80s. It was not diverse at all at the time. Mm-hmm. And so we went to Sudan a lot for vacations. And then, you know, we'd go to my grandma's house where my uncle lived, and all the cousins would get together and sit on the ground, and he would tell us these stories that he heard from, you know, my great-grandma, who, you know, this woman was illiterate, right?
Okay.
They don't read, they don't write, but it's the stories they heard.
But that's how people told stories, like back in the day, like it was oral tradition. Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Could you give a shout-out to your uncle, you know, on each episode of the podcast?
I do. Yeah. My uncle, Al-Bahir, thankfully he is with us, alive and well from this war. He was able to evacuate. And leave his home. He had to leave the country. Thankfully, again, he is safe and sound in another country. But, you know, it's been a traumatizing time for him and for a lot of our elders who've had to evacuate and just flee.
Yeah, my heart goes out to everybody who's dealing with that. Mm-hmm. And like I said, it does not get talked enough about what's going on in Sudan. So, and you've been very vocal about it. I've learned a lot from you. And not just about the trauma, but also the beauty, too, of the culture and the country, which is another reason why I love this podcast. Do you think hearing these stories played a role in you being a journalist? I mean,
100%.
Storytelling.
Like, I would go from my little Houston, Texas world of, we have everything here for children, right? Like, children's media is huge. It's Disney. It's them Saturday morning cartoons with the cereal, right?
Right.
We had the world here in terms of children's media. And then I'd go back to this place where it's not as rich as it is here. We don't have all the media we have here. All we had was these oral traditions where this one man would be standing and he would be acting out the characters and performing, right? And it mesmerized me that one person can be just telling you a story with his voice, with no sound effects, with no animation, no cartoons, that, you know, it just amazed me.
Yeah.
And I knew this was something that one day I would want to do. And radio is big in Sudan as well. Radio is the lifeline. The radio is always on. It's how you know what's going on locally. You know, not everybody has televisions. Not everybody is able to afford, you know, other kinds of media.
Right.
And so for a long time, radio was it. So I think it was those two things together, just like listening, having the radio on all the time and hearing these stories, for sure.
So Little Hannah was like, my voice is going to come out that speaker one day.
I just fell in love with storytelling.
Yeah, especially too when they're animated. I'm still, even at this age in my mid-40s, I'm still, that little girl inside, when she hears Once Upon a Time, it's like, I'm there, you know.
You know, and the oral storytelling part, when it's somebody, you know, a bedtime story.
Yeah.
Come, let me tell you a story.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? There's something to that that's lost in screen world that we have today. And so that's what I love.
Well, I want folks to hear, you know, what you do with this podcast. So here's an excerpt from the folktale Lullaby and the Ego. I love the beat to it when you're singing the song. So in this folktale, a brother, he is hunting for food, and he ends up catching a magical singing eagle. So take a listen.
The eagle sang again.
Lullaby, lullaby, bit the sagr alwali, bit the sab'a sa'ali, abuk bid ya lullaby, fi eid sagir ya lullaby, dalil bagar ya lullaby, dalil ghanam ya lullaby.
Suddenly, the ground began to shake. The brother looked up, and from over the mountain came a stampede of fat cows and goats, more animals than their brother had ever seen. These could last them for years and years, and they would never be hungry. The eagle said, "These animals will feed you and your sister forever. Now will you let me go?"
Hannah, you were singing. You talk like the characters. I was listening to one where you were talking like a goat.
How
did it feel to step out of your comfort zone?
Oh man, I mean, for a very long time, I didn't think I could do this. I was like, this isn't my lane. I am, you know, I'm in news. I'm in podcast. Like, it's not fiction what I do. And so it was hard to even come to this, you know, like, am I worthy? There was imposter syndrome, like, I'm not an actor, right? And this is like voice acting and animated. I did not think I could do this.
You're so good at it, though. You're so good.
But it took a lot of just reassuring from people that I love. My muse is a woman named Diane Furlatt. Mm-hmm. Who is an Oakland-based storyteller of African-American stories.
Okay.
Miss Diane is my mentor, and I went to her before I even embarked on any of this and said, give me some inspiration. Mm-hmm. Can I really do this? All I am is a journalist, right? I talk on the radio, but what you do is so amazing. And she said, no, you know, she gave me some training. She said, believe in yourself. You could do this. You have it in you. And, you know, and so I just did it.
I would have never
I did the
known.
Goats. I did the sheep. I did the monsters. I'm going to do witches. It's fun. And it feels good to be stepping out of what you usually do, kind of your day job.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a lot of fun.
I can tell you're having fun with it. I can hear it in your voice, and I would never have thought that you were nervous because the writing is good too as well. You know, you really take us there, and like, you're like, oh, and the goat wants to eat like the nice fresh grass. And I was like, I don't even eat grass, but that made me want to, that made me want to eat some grass and drink out the cool river. And I don't even do that. I love too that it's mixed with Arabic too as well.
Yes.
So like, you know, so you really, you know, take us there. And then to just preserve that culture, the images on the YouTube, I watch it and listen to it on YouTube, mm-hmm. And the images on there.
That's my cousin.
That's your cousin.
It's a family affair, this podcast.
I know, it's doing like your mama.
Funding is scarce. This had to be self-funded. It's a passion project, something that I love. I have amazing engineers, current KLW and former KLW mm-hmm. sound designers who have been generous with me to such a large extent. And I got my family to be on this. My editor is my mom.
Okay, yeah, when I heard that, I said, this is a family affair.
I'm like, you're my editor. Okay. I'm like, yes,
no.
You're the editor.
Well, you all are doing a really great job. Did you tell these stories to your kids?
Ooh.
Because yeah. They're a different generation. So.
They are a different generation. My daughters are in college now. When they were little, I did tell them these stories. Now, they are kids who were born, raised here in these United States, did not get the chance to go to Sudan a lot, don't have the grasp of Arabic that mm-hmm. I maybe had. So I had to do a lot of translation.
Okay.
The songs, I kept them in there, just like I keep them in there in the folk tales.
Yeah.
And some terminology that I explain, like if I say, and Habboba said, and then I say, Grandma said.
Yes.
So now you know that Habboba means grandma.
Right.
That's what I did with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so they know a lot of these stories, but that was a big deal too. Like, who am I to translate folk tales and folklore?
Mm.
That was something that I really had to also pause and make sure it was okay. It was like, who do folk tales belong to? That was a question. You know, as journalists, we are very careful about
right.
like who what belongs to who.
Yeah.
Right. And so I had to sit with that for a long time as well and realize that folk tales are living and breathing. They don't belong to anybody.
I was gonna ask you, because you're saying, like, are you saying as far as like maybe this folk tale is from a different culture, community in Sudan compared to maybe another? Is that what you were thinking? Like, oh, maybe this community, this culture in Sudan, they tell this folk story, but this other community tells this story, and who am I to? Is that where you were struggling? Because I'm surprised.
I mean, I was struggling with who do folk tales belong to?
Okay.
Like, who do they belong to? And am I allowed, are they mine to tell?
Yeah.
Are they mine to translate into a whole nother language? Like, whose right is that?
Okay, I see now.
And so I went into a whole rabbit hole of researching about folklore and folktales worldwide. And it sounded like everybody was saying folktales are global, they're universal. You can hear the same story.
You can.
Here and halfway across the world with different characters and different, details. But the overall story is similar,
right,
and the same. And that's amazing to me. We have lots of stories with like the evil stepmom and the two sisters. Mm-hmm. And one is kind and one is mean.
Right.
That's universal.
Right.
And that just showed me that folktales take the form and the flavor of whoever is telling
it. Yeah. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with KALW's Hannah Baba about her new podcast, which is so gorgeous, Folk Tales from Sudan. And starting next week, you can see her tell these stories in person. So bring the kitties, the grandkitties, the kid inside of you to the Oakland Public Library. She'll be at a branch near you. Now, earlier I mentioned the conflict going on in Sudan. And so I remember when we had our Cross Currents Live event, and you had Sudanese dancers who were so cute there. And you had a conversation with a friend of yours who's an attorney. And you mentioned, like, because what's going on in Sudan, like, you know, as far as, I mean, you know, sadly, people are being killed, but also, too, is killing the culture, you know, because when time, you know, with civil war, people burn libraries, do mm-hmm. all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's funny because I'm hearing you say, who am I to do this? But I also know, too, this is about preserving, you know, the culture.
For sure.
Right?
For sure. Absolutely. Like when this war began 2 years ago, actually, it's hard to say that, but we just started seeing video after video of this museum's being destroyed and looted. The National Archives, the National Records, the music libraries at the National Radio Station. And you'd see videos of like tapes just on the ground. So this is also about preserving culture. And it's also about showing people that, you know, there's a little more to a country than what you see in the headlines. Right.
Yeah.
It's fighting that. That single story that Chimamanda Adichie talked about, that yes, war and poverty and misery are part of who we are and where we come from, but there's also beauty and joy. And that's what I want to bring.
What's your favorite folktale?
Oh, God.
And I haven't heard all of them, but I've heard a number of them. What's your favorite one so far?
Oh, man, there's many, but I would have to say one that just dropped, I think. It's called Fatna and the Ghoul.
It just came out a couple of days ago,
And that's just one that I've loved from my childhood, because there's a mean old ogre, right? And there's this.
And she does the voices.
And and then another thing is I had to change a little bit of these folk tales. Some things were, I needed to make them, what do we say?
Not as
non-problematic and politically correct. Mm. For example, Fatma in this story, originally, because it's an old, old story, she's just a girl that stays at home doing nothing all day, waiting for her brother to come home. And I'm like, it is 2025. How do I add something to Fatma's character as a woman, but stay authentic? That's another thing that was interesting with this project. So now I have her, like, she's reading her favorite books.
Ahead.
Know, she's literate. She's literate. So some changes like that as well. But that's been a fun process, too. So that's the story I would pick.
So she has a life.
She has a life. It's still not, you know, it's still not a 2025 life, but I had to keep a little authenticity.
Yeah.
And people know this is like way long ago in a land far, far away.
Yeah, that's why I said I love it too, because, you know, we're entering the story world of a different culture in Sudan. And it's like, you know me, I have a big imagination. I was the only child. My mother's only child. So when I sit and listen to it, I'm like, because I was like, I can see somebody playing this for their kid, like before they go to sleep.
That's what's special about audio.
Yes, yes.
No screen, no images.
No.
You get to imagine what the ghoul looks like.
Yeah.
You get to imagine everything.
Yeah, yeah.
I love that about audio.
Yeah, because it's only like I said, you can get it at, you know, one of your favorite like podcast platform, but I listen to it on YouTube, so there's only one image and it's usually a beautiful image, so you still have to let your, you know, your mind wander. What are the kids saying?
Ooh, well, it's the parents, interestingly, emailing me and commenting and sending me messages about, you know, we love this. Some are asking that question about, well, where's the animation, right?
Really?
Like, the kids are just used to
they want
cartoons. So I feel like I'm teaching people or helping them unlearn this thing of it has to be a visual.
Yeah.
But parents are just loving it, and it's really humbling to get an email or get a comment saying, we have never seen these stories before.
Right, right.
And this is the first time we're hearing about these stories.
Yeah.
That's the biggest compliment to me. Just if I'm able to help one person hear a story from Sudan that's not about war, I'm happy.
What is the community saying?
Oh. The community is excited.
Okay.
They haven't heard these stories in English, and that's throwing some people off a little bit,
okay.
A little bit. So it's like, huh, it's new.
Okay.
It's different.
Which explains to the nervousness that you had too as well.
To translate and to do this in English.
Right.
Yeah. So it's throwing some people off, but overall, the reaction has been really, really positive. Folks are excited to take this into their workplaces and to their colleges and to just share it with non-Sudanese people to say, hey, this is a part of my culture, too.
Now, I can definitely see it being taught in school. And I'm not just saying that just because we're coworkers, but I definitely can see it being taught in college classrooms. I have a couple more questions and then we'll wrap up. You know, you talked about, we touched upon how, you know, this shows a different side of Sudan than what, the conversation is usually focused on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you talked about traveling to visit when you were younger. What is beautiful about Sudan?
The people. Yeah. Isn't that always the thing?
Yeah.
It's the people, the warmth of the folks there. We have these big houses with huge yards. And everybody gathers in the yard every evening.
Yeah.
Cousins and aunties and uncles. So it's like it's the warmth of family. It's also the Nile that goes through the country as well. It's the smell. I could still smell, you know, just like being sitting there next to the River Nile with palm trees of, you know. It's hard for me to now talk about this because it's kind of gone and at the back of my mind I kind of know I don't think we're going back to Sudan anymore.
Wow.
Because the devastation that has happened now, the most generous estimates say 20 years till it is rebuilt.
That's heartbreaking.
And that's if the war stops today. So there are whole generations of Sudanese kids in the diaspora who probably just won't be able to go or see it. Right. And that's another thing. That's another reason, I think, why I brought these stories. Just like, OK, if we can't go back to Sudan, we're going to bring the Sudan to us and create little Sudans in our little communities. But it's the warmth. It's the people. Yeah. It's the place.
Wow. Well, I mean, I'm not Sudanese, but I just want to say thank you for doing this. I think, you know, it's a gift. To you, I think, you know, and I think it's a gift to your culture and to your community and for us to learn. I know you talked about, too, just, and I know we got to wrap up, but I know you mentioned, too, how sometimes people have more empathy, you know, when they can connect through story. So I know, you know, this project is so many layers to why it's so important. So I'm glad that you found the courage and you got past insecurities that we all face. And you said, I got to put this out there so that, you know, that can keep going on for generations and generations. So
thank you, Janae.
Yeah,
thank you so much.
Yeah, anytime. I've been speaking with KALW's Hanna Baba. Her podcast, Folk Tales from Sudan, is available on your favorite podcast platform. Also hear Hanna tell these stories in person at various branches of the Oakland Public Library. That tour begins Wednesday, May 14th, and we'll have more details online. And next up, we're going to hear some really, really good music that's going to be playing during the San Francisco International Arts Festival. Stay with us. Welcome back. You're listening to the Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darden. The San Francisco International Arts Festival is wrapping up this weekend, and attendees have enjoyed works from artists abroad and here in the Bay. There's a lot of live music to check out before the festival ends, including Pablo Quintero. Pablo is from Colombia, and that music you just heard is by him. He blends Latin American rhythms with looping technology, which makes him a one-man band. Pablo is also a guitarist, a producer, a music educator and sound engineer. He'll be performing this Saturday night at the Abanico, I think I pronounced that right, Coffee Roasters in the Mission. And I'm so happy he's here on my show. Welcome, Pablo.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, thanks for being here. So, Pablo, okay, I got some questions. Of course I do, because
that's
why you're here. Okay, so you also go by the name Malpica.
No, my actual name is Malpica. My artist name is Malpica. My normal name with normal people is Pablo, but, you know, my artist name, it's Malpica.
Okay, so which do you prefer to be called?
Malpica.
Okay, so you prefer to be called Malpica. Okay, so talk about the name. Like, what does that mean? What does Malpica mean?
It's my last name.
Oh,
it's my second last name. It doesn't really have much story more than a lot of story of the last name. you know, okay. like the family, Malpica family has always been a fighter. It's always been like, come on, let's do this. Let's get better, you know, from Colombia. So that's my mom's last name. Okay. My first last name is Quintero, but I like that name because it just reflects who I am. And that's what I was called in high school all the time. So everybody knows me as Malpica in Colombia. So that's why I chose that name.
Okay, got it. That makes it. And I was reading in your bio, you started playing music when you were only 5 years old and your parents had to hide your instruments so they could sleep.
Yes.
Because you were just like, you were jamming out. And so now you're here in the Bay Area. How has it been for you as a musician here?
Well, it's been great. It's been a growth, definitely. I've been performing since everything opened up after COVID because I got here right before COVID, like on February 2020. And of course, everybody was freaking out and I had to lock down myself. I was living in a recording studio in Sebastopol, California, and I wasn't supposed to stay. Everything was just an accident that I love that that accident happened. I wasn't supposed to live in California, so I decided to stay after COVID. And it's been great. It's been a really good, you know, reception of my music. I started in the North Bay, like in the wineries in Sonoma County and, you know, a little bit of Napa. And then I moved closer to the city, and that's when I started performing more in the San Francisco Bay Area and East Bay. And I've been running a lot of shows. As a matter of fact, I am the director of a Latin festival that just happened 2 weeks ago at Music City. And we had seven bands, and it was a total blast, a lot of community. So it's been great. It's been great because I'm trying to create a community in a Latin community, especially in the music scene on the San Francisco Bay Area, because I want to recover the history that San Francisco had as a, you know, and the Bay Area in general as a really reputation of musicians and really well-known and great artists. You know, we know that Santana is from here.
Yes.
We know that, you know, Metallica is from here. We know, so it's just so amazing the amount of talent that you see in the Bay Area and also the Latin talent. So I feel like I am an ambassador of the Latin music in the Bay Area.
So I want folks to hear a little bit more of your music. So a lot of your music is about romance, I understand. So let's listen to your song Camino al Mar, which translates to Walk to the Sea.
Otra mañana, una brisa ajena, me levanta en otro lugar. Te vi en un sueño, bailando con seguridad. Mientras sonaba esta tambora, me lo tomé como señal que siempre se puede encontrar un rinconcito para celebrar la vida en cualquier lugar. Así que dejémoslo todo y vamos al mar. Ahí, dejémoslo todo y vamos al mar. Voy camino al mar y espero que vengas conmigo. Cierra y que entra el sereno. Quédate conmigo. Y esos ojos negros que miran al cielo.
So I understand that song is about you and a special someone enjoying time together in the sea. We have a few more minutes. So tell us about the song. Like, where did the inspiration come from?
The inspiration came from escaping to the routine and escaping the world that we have to be sometimes, this responsible adult life where you have a job and you have a routine and you have to do everything. So it was inspired of a weekend or maybe a day that you just like, you know what, I decided to go to the ocean. Do you want to go with me? And also, is this like person, special persons that you want, that you're being wanted to tell her or tell him how you feel? And so I'm saying, I'm going to the ocean. I hope you go with me and your eyes look at me. And I think we're ready for the moment. And the moment could reflect a lot of stuff. It could be a kiss. It could be a moment of connection. It could be a hug. It could be a lot of stuff. So that's why I don't want to be like super specific about it.
Yeah. Well, it's definitely a beautiful song. And
Thank you.
Yeah. And I understand you performed with Colombian artist Carlos Vives.
I recorded for him an album back in 2021.
Okay, so for folks who may not know, he's one of the best-selling Latin American artists in the world. He has sold 20 million copies of his albums, and he's collaborated with artists such as Shakira and Marc Anthony. So definitely somebody iconic. What was that like?
Oh, that was amazing. That was an incredible experience that I had a chance because it was all by accident. Like, you know, I was working in a different project back in the time, and you know, and Carlos Vives heard about that project, which was recovering music that he was heard on the 2000, and the genre was called tropipop. It's tropical with pop. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. It was really popular in Colombia. So one producer hired me because I played a lot of tropipop in my youth, and I was a big fan. So I started creating this project for them. And then when Carlos Vives heard about it, he jumped into the project, and that's when I knew that he was going to be in the project and I was going to be recording for him guitars. It was amazing. And then I had the pleasure to meet him in Los Angeles twice, once in 2022 and the other one in 2024.
Wow. Okay. So that's really, really awesome. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
And briefly, because we got to wrap up, but what can people expect at your show this weekend, Pablo? Mapica, excuse me.
Yeah, no worries. You can expect a lot of joy.
Nice.
I can guarantee you that my music brings joy to people, and I think I have a gift, and my gift is to bring joy with my music to people. And I'm playing with my, you know, with a looper myself, with a, like kind of a Sheeran looper, a Sheeran style kind of what he does, you know, like, because he creates his own sounds. There's no backing tracks. Mm-hmm. There's nothing. They create, he drums it. And I was inspired by him to do that. But the difference is that when he's doing pop, I'm doing cumbia.
Nice, nice.
Yeah, cumbia and salsa and bossa nova. So I mix a lot of rhythms, so you can expect that for
all,
sure.
All right. So, okay, y'all. So you know what to expect with joy and a good time. Mapica, thank you so much for your time. Thank you.
You're
for,
very welcome.
Yes.
Thank you so much for the interview.
Yes.
Yeah.
I've been speaking with musician Mapica, or also Pablo Quintero, and you can see him perform during the San Francisco International Arts Festival. He'll be at Abanico, forgive me if I mispronounce the name, Coffee Roasters this Saturday in the Mission. And that's all the time we have for the Sights and Sounds show with Janae Darden. Thank you to our show producer, Porfirio Rango, board operator, Damian Miner, and our director of audio programming, David Boyer. And thank you for tuning in. Visit the Sights and Sounds page on KALW.org for information about our guests. And an early happy Mother's Day to all of the mothers and mother figures out there. Much love to anyone who is grieving a mother or mother figure this weekend. My heart goes out to you. And we'll have another great show for you right here next Wednesday at 4 p.m. Until then, be good to yourselves and each other.